Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Today is publication day. Wow, Brad, congratulations.
Thank you, Barbara, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. This is Deadfall. This is the 22nd Scott Harbath thriller and Brad's 23rd book. And we were just talking, lurking in a pile in front of is the one not Scott Harbath book.
The Athena Project.
And when did you write it?
2009, published in 2010.
Did you write two books that year?
I did.
Wow.
I did, yeah.
What, you were seized with an idea you couldn't resist?
Yeah, and I wanted to plant my flag in this concept of an all-female Delta Force team. And so I did. I wrote a Harbath book that year. And one of the things when I talk about, because you can see all the books and everything, I always tell people that my books are like the James Bond movies. If you've never seen a Bond movie, and there's one in the cinema right now, you can go out and see it. It doesn't matter that you haven't seen any of the other ones. So if you haven't read a Brad Thor book, you can start with Deadfall. You will not be left behind.
No, you won't be left behind, but there is character development and some references back. The plots are all book to book, incomplete. But I do think that a brand new reader might wonder who a Norwegian ninja is, for example.
This idea of don't cannibalize your own sales was taught to me by my editor. And what she said was, you don't want someone to come into the poison pen and be looking for this book by Brad Thor, and you have my fifth and sixth book, but they were coming for the fourth book, and so they're not going to buy the fifth or sixth.
Right.
So the idea is that you really can jump in anywhere. Mm-hmm. If you're a purist and you want to start at the beginning with Lions of Lucerne, you absolutely can. What I find is a lot of people will actually come for the latest book. New readers will come and read the latest book, love it, and then want to go back and see what were all the stories, what were the missions and all the excitement for Scott Harbath before the most recent book.
Absolutely true. So it's Brad and my job to get all you new people to read Deadfall, which is what we're here to talk about. And then way down here on the bottom, in point of fact, is the very first, I'm sorry, Brad, there we go. Yeah. The very first Scott Harbath, The Lions of Lucerne. So you will discern from this that these are international thrillers in the sense that they go to interesting locations all around the globe. Yeah, one of the reasons I love reading them is I get windows into places that I am not going to go. And in this new book, the primary location is, in fact, in the Ukraine, where I'm pretty sure Brad didn't go either.
I did not. And so I went to Afghanistan in 2008 during the war, but there really weren't bombs being dropped to the extent and missiles flying the way they are in Ukraine. So if I can't go to a location, I want to talk to somebody, preferably in the special operations community, in the intelligence community, maybe somebody who's a diplomat for the United States, people whose jobs depend on paying attention to the details when they are in these places. To give you an example, I was introduced to a Green Beret, and I was doing a book, my book Code of Conduct, and I was doing the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he had operated there. And he got introduced to me, and I got to call him, and I said, well, I'm looking for some color detail. And he said, like what? And I said, I don't know. And he said, Thor, listen, I agreed to give you 5 minutes. You tell me what you want here. Don't waste my time. Don't waste yours. And I said, okay. Do they all have the same bicycle over there? And he goes, oh, my God, yeah, they do have the same bicycle. Right. And he said it's actually called a Black Mamba because the bikes are painted black and the tires leave tracks in the dirt roads that look like a Black Mamba snake has gone through. So I put that in Code of Conduct, and I had people show up on social media and say, you must have been there, because only people who have been there know that. So that's the kind of thing I like to put in the books, those color details that if I can't go, somebody who's been there gave me that detail.
It's wonderful. Also, if you have been there, it's sort of fun to take Brad's, to get Brad's take on it. For example, when he was in Svalbard in Upper Norway, I have been there. I've actually been around Norway all the way to Murmansk, where I might tell you it was 97 degrees. So Russia, it does have an ice-free port, and increasingly so, but no air conditioning. But anyway, Svalbard's a particularly fascinating island full of polar bears, and you're not allowed to move outside of a very small area without a guide with you with a gun because the bears are dangerous the whole bit. So it's been fun to, to travel. Now, I have to tell you that in 2011, my husband and I took a cruise around the Black Sea. It was maybe the most peaceful cruise we have ever taken. We started in Istanbul, we went up, we went into the Black Sea, and we rotated around this way, and we went to Georgia while it was being readied, or Georgia, and then the area is getting ready for the Russian Olympics. But when we got to what is now part of the territory in dispute, Sebastopol and Odessa, I studied Russian in college, so I said to Rob, why don't we just go off on our own while we're here in Sebastopol, which is where the Russian Navy is located? And we got into a little wooden Russian tour boat. We were the only Russian people there, and I sort of bluffed my way through, you know, do svidaniya, all of it. And we toured the Russian Navy. We actually sailed through it. I took photos the whole bit, and I thought, how is that possible that that was only 12 years ago? Then we went to Odessa and visited the wineries and all the rest of it. And I mean, you would never have thought that what is happening now would be happening, and quite so soon. It was just a peaceful, beautiful, friendly trip.
And Odessa just got hammered with missiles in the last couple of days.
Yeah, because of it's such a big port.
It's
a big port
and the grain output, because with the cost of crude going down, the Russians are losing a lot of money. The central bank in Russia just raised the interest rates by a full point. And so they're trying to drive up the price of grain and push the Ukrainians out of the market. So they've now, they've gotten out of the Black Sea Agreement, where they guaranteed safe passage. And so they were bombarding, and they hit at least one, I think, UNESCO World Heritage Site. There was a cathedral there, which which is terrible, but they are very indiscriminate. In fact, I would just say that wasn't indiscriminate. That wasn't an accident. They hit what they intend to hit, whether it's civilian infrastructure like electrical power plants and water treatment plants and things like that, all those things that are prohibited in warfare from doing, they're doing. So the Ukrainians are suffering a ton because of that.
Did not mention, let's talk about the book jacket for a minute before we get really into the plot. This beautiful cover is the colors of the Ukrainian flag, right?
Yep. So it's interesting, because I like to tell people can I give you what the book is about?
And then
then there's a real life tie-in, which is kind of interesting. So I grew up reading Alistair MacLean books. I loved Alistair MacLean.
The Guns of Navarone.
The Guns of Navarone, Ice Station Zebra, which we just saw the movie for. I'd never seen the movie before with Rock Hudson, and I saw it a week ago, and it was fantastic. Great, great interpretation of the book. But I loved Where Eagles Dare, which got made into a fabulous movie with Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. So I had always wanted to take Harvath, my hero, and put him into one of those World War II kind of plots, but I couldn't do that because he's contemporary, and there wasn't a land war in Europe where I could do that. And I love Saving Private Ryan. I love Band of Brothers on HBO. I love the Brad Pitt movie Fury. And so when the Ukrainian war was happening, I thought, okay, this is going to be my chance. And so I'm going to have an American go missing behind enemy lines in Ukraine. And because the U.S. cannot officially put boots on the ground, they are going to get Scott Harvath, my protagonist, to basically sever his ties with the United States and join the Ukrainian International Legion, which allows him to enter as a combatant into that war in search for this woman. And so that was my way of doing my own Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers. It was kind of the jumping off point. So this thing is set in present day. It is in Ukraine, but it isn't necessarily all about the politics around it and all that kind of stuff. It's really about the action, which starts right from the beginning and just keeps going throughout the book.
Well, it does. And actually, in order to take something as big a picture as a war like that, for storytelling purposes, it works better to focus on an individual.
Right.
You know, I mean, what is the difference between, the death of three is a tragedy and the death of 3,000 is a statistic or something along those lines?
Exactly.
Right. So, she is a very admirable. She's from Chicago. She's a lawyer. She's Ukrainian by ancestry. And she has gone into the Ukraine, and she's working in an orphanage, which is under dire attack. And so she's taken prisoner. and there we are.
Francis Fukuyama had a line that I really liked, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And so what drove me with this book is the real-life Russian mercenary group called the Wagner Group, which Putin has been using mercilessly, particularly in Ukraine, and they've been committing horrific war crimes. What's interesting is that in August of 1944, the Polish Home Army led a revolt against the Nazis as the Nazis were pulling out of Poland, because the Polish Home Army thought that the Red Army was going to be coming in, and they paused in the suburbs outside Warsaw because they wanted the Nazis to put this rebellion down so that they could come in and take over Warsaw and basically not have any resistance to their rule. And Hitler unleashed one of the most horrific SS brigades into Warsaw from August to October, and some of the worst war crimes of World War II outside of the concentration camps happened in and around Warsaw with this terrible, terrible brigade. So I was that Francis Fukuyama line was banging around in my head because we were seeing not the repeat of history, but an echo of history, because that's exactly what Putin was doing with the Wagner Group in Ukraine. And I thought, okay, this is my Alistair MacLean novel. This is my World War II setting, my Saving Private Ryan that I could do with Harvath. It is easily the most intense book, Barbara, I have ever written. It was very emotional and painful to do the research into not only what the Nazis did in World War II, which was horrific, and I go into it in the book, but just what's happened in Ukraine at the hands of the Russians. So this whole thing is very the colors are beautiful, and the actual golden tipped wings of this statue in Kiev and the raven sitting on top, you'll have to read the book to figure out what it means, but it's very symbolic for the story, which is fun.
Yes, it is, and the raven is a particularly nice touch, which you will discover when you read the book. You know, it is so devastating to recognize the Nazi playbook all over again here, because not only the atrocities and all, but looting. Because, you know, part of your book is, it reminds me a little bit of the Monuments Men.
That's another touchstone. Yes,
exactly. And that is, I mean, so much of culture is at risk in a war like this.
And that's part of the genocide, is you steal the cultural treasures and you also steal the children, which is what Russia has been doing, too. They claim they're moving them to safer places in Russia. Right. But that's genocide. So you take the art, you take all of kind of the history of the people, and you take their children, and that's how you commit the genocide. Then you wipe everybody else out, which is exactly what they've been trying to do.
Well, I mean, there's a false claim there that, you know, it's really Russia, and there's just, I mean, that was the premise on here, is that he was going to reclaim, you know, Russia.
He was going to knit back together the Russian Empire. And he started out, Putin started out, and again, this is fiction, and I'm trying to give you a white-knuckle thrill ride, but the actual historic touchstones are very interesting, because Putin originally invaded eastern Ukraine, the Donbas, claiming that he was going in to protect ethnic Russians, Russian-speaking people, which is the same excuse that Hitler used for his invasion of Czechoslovakia when the French Republic, Fascist Italy, and the UK, via Neville Chamberlain, waving that piece of paper, Peace in Our Time, gave up the Sudetenland to Hitler, thinking it would slake his thirst for conquest. So again, I keep coming back to history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And for someone who wanted to create a contemporary version of a World War II exciting thriller where the hero's up against... We were taught in creative writing at the University of Southern California that we were taught there was this kind of shorthand. They said Rocky and Jesus. Rocky and Jesus, that's what they would pound into us. That was a likable protagonist who's up against insurmountable odds, who achieves his objective in the end. And so that's what I really wanted to do with Harvath. And I wanted to do a lot of the things you would see in World War II movies, where you didn't know, were you really talking to an agent of a friendly intelligence service? Or was this somebody that had put that agent in the trunk of their car and you were talking to one of the bad guys? So that it really was a lot of fun. Tough to write, very intense, but really satisfied an urge I'd had for a long time as a writer.
Well, there was always, too, the risk that actual events could overtake your book.
Yeah.
But not really, because the way you wrote it, even if
Evergreen,
the circumstances had changed, it would. Since you've been talking about movies, I'm going to mention one more, because mm-hmm. you've actually written it here on page 20. Since the beginning of the invasion, someone had taken a cue from the classic Cold War era movie Red Dawn and had been spray painting the word Wolverines on destroyed Russian vehicles across the Ukraine. So you give Scott a kind of little impulse there.
And it's true. That's really happening in Ukraine. And so that's why I covered that. So if for those of you watching, if you've seen the movie Red Dawn, the high school kids that launch a guerrilla effort against the invading communist forces, their high school football team, their mascot was the Wolverine. And right. so when they would destroy Russian equipment, they would spray paint it in the movie with the word Wolverines. And the Ukrainians started doing that. So there was kind of this plucky, you know, fighting spirit. And they were using this American movie as kind of a cultural touch point in the war, which I thought was kind of cool. And I wanted to put that in the book.
There is a theory of history called the Great Man Theory of History, which I've explored with some other authors recently. And you know, the idea is that one person can truly alter events as opposed to, you know, tidal forces and same thing. My position is that Britain would not have survived without Churchill.
Agreed.
I think we would not have gotten through the Depression and the war without Roosevelt. Certainly the Civil War would have been totally different if Lincoln hadn't been president. And the worst thing John Wilkes Booth could have ever done for the South was to assassinate Lincoln. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you believe in the great man theory, then you have to be looking right at the moment at Zelensky, because who knew, you know, right. that this man was going to rise
this
up
actor.
And become Winston Churchill and George Washington and the whole bit. And that's a thing that Putin did not... You know, just couldn't calculate, did not recognize that it could take one person, a touchstone like Zelensky, who by sheer force of will and whatever can rally people in a way that Putin can't do.
No, and what's interesting is in the book, because I know there are people that are divided on this issue in the United States, and I have characters with all different points of view on this in the book. What's interesting, and I talk about it in the book, and I direct people to this, is that in real life, at the end of the Soviet Union's lifespan, when the Cold War ended, a third of the Soviet Union's nukes were in Ukraine. And we went to the Ukrainians and said, listen, we're begging you. Let us help you decommission these nukes and get rid of them for you. You don't want these. You cannot maintain these, and you can't protect them. We were operating in our own self-interest, because we did not want terrorists to steal nukes from the Ukrainians and then light one off in downtown Phoenix or in Minneapolis or Miami or New York or Little Rock. We really wanted these things off the chessboard. And so the Ukrainians agreed, but they had a stipulation. They said, we will agree to this if you agree to guarantee that if we give up these nukes, we will never lose an inch of our sovereign territory. And so this was in the 1990s. The U.S. signed it. It was called the Budapest Memorandum. And they said, get the Russians to sign it. So I believe it was Gorbachev that signed it. And the Russians did sign. This is pre-Putin. But then fast forward to 2014, and Putin invades the Donbass, eastern Ukraine. They go for the Crimean Peninsula. And all we do is kick them out of the G8. That's why we have a G7 now. We threw the Russians out because of that. They got a strongly worded letter and some sanctions. And so it was very similar. Again, Francis Fukuyama, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. So we thought that would be enough and Putin wouldn't go any further, just like they thought Hitler would stop with the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. And I keep calling Putin Hitler because there's so many similarities. But so Putin didn't stop. So I tell people that we made a promise as the United States to the Ukrainians. It was in our self-interest to get the nukes out of Ukraine so that those nukes couldn't be used against us in the United States. And we did not live up to that promise. That was a bad thing when Biden was vice president. And we didn't. We did not help get the Russians out of there. Now we've got that chance. And there are Russians who are being forced to fight there, who are dying by the thousands. And there are Russian mothers and grandmothers and wives and children who are crying their eyes out because they've lost people in this war. The best thing we could have is a very quick ending to it. And we do that by giving Zelensky not the 50th time he asked for something, but the first time he asked for something. And I did a radio interview this morning, and the host said, and give him everything he wants two times. Give him double what he wants. And just like, let's get this over. It's the moral thing to want this over as quickly as possible. Give him what he needs.
Well, you know, Brad, it's not just the moral thing, but let's go back to, you know, Neville Chamberlain and peace in our time. If we let Russia, if we sit back and they take the Ukraine, the next country to tee up is probably Poland.
Probably Poland.
But, you know, they're not, the lesson they will have is that they can go forward.
Yes.
Rather than stop. Then the other side of the globe, we should be also thinking about what Beijing is thinking about all this. So, you know, the stakes in it are, as you point out, it's in our self-interest to defend the Ukraine and help them win the war and end it, because otherwise we're inevitably going to be dragged towards World War III anyway.
And the Chinese want us to stay in this cycle of giving munitions to the Ukrainians, because the Chinese want to see us bleed out. We would like, it'd be great to see the Russians bleed out and their military to just crumble into dust, but it's not the morally correct thing to do, because Russians are dying and Ukrainians are dying. It's the sooner we can just absolutely unequivocally have Putin defeated, the better it is for us. Chinese would love for it to drag out, because that helps them. That helps them vis-a-vis Taiwan and that kind of stuff. So
what we really need is Scott Harvath.
There you go.
To head off into, you know, whatever bunker Putin is hiding in. But actually, you know, it's one of the reasons we like to read books about heroes. You know, we all wish.
Absolutely.
That's the Marvel comic, you know, appeal and
it,
so forth.
It is,
forth.
And I like that. I like the good guy triumphs against evil, and it's, you know, it's not Putin in my books. It's a Russian president that I created many, many books ago.
Right.
He's not called Putin. So this is really something, and again, I have different viewpoints. There are, there's a whole storyline in D.C., and there's some people that are arguing what's the right thing to do vis-a-vis America's involvement in Ukraine. So it's supposed to be fun, though. This is, I mean, the discussion is very interesting, and we're very passionate about geopolitical affairs and things like that. But the book has just turned those pages and have a good ride.
The book is fun. And I was going to say that, you know, we've talked about the Ukraine plot, but there is, in fact, a man who falls to death. You know, and I love it. You know, this sort of defenestration syndrome.
Right, sudden Russian death syndrome.
Sudden Russian death syndrome.
Gravity, the biggest killer.
But anyway, there he is in D.C., and the FBI guy, I think it's the FBI guy.
Yep, Joe Carolan.
Right, who is at the scene, feels in his bones that it wasn't a suicide.
Right.
And then he discovers, which we won't go into, other things that lead him to believe that, in fact, this was a murder, and then, in fact, this is, again, Russian assets. Now, really interestingly, and completely off point of your book here, but I will mention it, next week we're going to be talking to an author named Bruce Borgos in his debut novel. I regret that I can't at the moment think of the name, because that's what happens when you get old, is that names, the title goes away. But the premise of this book goes all the way back to 1957, and a Russian asset in eastern Nevada who is there to create a nuclear incident to divert one of the testing, one of the bombs to be tested to take out Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
But it goes into that whole history of Russians who were planted in this country. You know, Joe McCarthy wasn't 100% wrong. 99, but wow, not 100. A dreadful man in a dreadful period. And I remember, because I lived through it. I was, you know, I actually in the 50s, I was in high school and remember it very well. But we shouldn't overlook the idea that Russian assets have been among us for decades.
Chinese, Russian, the Nazis had people here. So that's always an issue that we deal with, is espionage, counter-espionage.
Right.
And so that was fun for me in the book to
that's
do.
That's right. So you are dealing with – so that's the second plot in
correct,
the book, is
correct,
the death in D.C., and does that say there is a Russian
less than
asset
a mile from the White House, which would be incredible for the Russians to operate that close to the president, that they would do something within eight blocks of the White House. It would be incredible. So,
absolutely true. Yeah. And our own political situation, one of the things Brad does talk about and other thriller writers have been discussing is our addiction to anger that has overtaken us in the last, whether it's politics of grievance or whatever, but a combination of political figures and the media and all kinds of groups with different interests have really created this kind of you know,
it's how they
anger
get you
cycle.
Coming back. So they want you angry so that you'll go out and vote.
Right.
They want you angry so you keep coming back to their website and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it has driven some of the tribal, a lot of the tribalism. You know, I always say there's more that unites us than divides us as Americans. And it's funny, I get asked, what do I think the biggest national security threat to the United States is? And I say Facebook. Because people who get into a Facebook page with other people who think just like them, they let their guard down. And actually, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and the North Koreans love to get into these Facebook pages because anything they put in there, if you think it's coming from a fellow believer in what you believe in, you're not as rigorous with testing the idea. You're more likely to believe it. So it's a place where people are extremely vulnerable. So yeah, I talk about in the book a little bit about how if you're angry, somebody's made you angry, and you need to think about who's manipulating you. Why does somebody want you angry? And this ties back with the Wagner Group, which is really interesting, the Russian mercenary force, because Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs the Wagner Group, he has another business that a lot of people don't know he's the head of. He's the head of the Russian troll farm in St. Petersburg called the Internet Research Agency. And they're the ones that have been implicated again and again and again in like lots of the bots on Twitter, lots of election interference, and kind of pressing on fractures in the American culture, trying to get people to bicker and to fight with each other. This is a big in real life Russian thing. So I have a guy similar to that in the book, and I lay out, I actually step people through, this is what they do. Because I think if people, again, white knuckle thrill ride, take it to the beach, take it to the lake. But if you close the book and you're like, wow, I didn't know that, I think that's the icing on the cake.
Absolutely. In the same way that your book in Norway pointed out, you know, the dangers of the Chinese.
They're pushing, you know, into the Arctic.
Not only pushing into the Arctic, but establishing a beachhead in Norway, you know, which I think the fact that the whole Arctic Ocean is becoming navigable for longer periods of time is really going to reroute global shipping.
Yes.
And I mentioned Murmansk. During World War II, Murmansk was basically an iced over port and gave the Russians very little chance to, you know, do any kind of naval stuff. And when you're there, you can see the old naval yards. But now, you know, now it's a real thing. And a lot of global shipping, instead of going around through the canal and other stuff, is just going to go over at the top of the world. It may change the strategic importance, for example, of the South China Sea, where so much shipping goes through, but it doesn't necessarily have to if instead it's going over
faster.
The top.
It saves about 2 weeks to go from Shanghai to Rotterdam if you can go over the top over Russia. And there are different choke points that the Chinese have to transit their ships through now that our Navy can shut down. But if they're going over Russia, they now get free passage and they don't have to worry about the U.S. Navy ever interdicting their ships or anything like that. So it could allow the Chinese Navy to actually drop ships very quickly off of the eastern seaboard of the United States. So it's a fascinating topic.
World keeps evolving, you know. All we can do is try to keep up. And, of course, that's the job of a thriller writer, is to mirror reality while giving you a wonderful time, which I think this book does. Now, one of the things that I love, there's all kinds of little Easter eggs in this book. And one of the ones I really love is that there's a scene in which a woman called Zira, who Scott Harbath catches up with at some point, and they're crossing or they're doing something, and a man at the checkpoint delivers a cheerful word. Can you pronounce it?
I cannot. I've seen it written. You can you can attempt it.
Palianitsia is what it sort of sounds like. But anyway, to which she replies, Palianitsia. And
it's one of my favorite
things. Then Harbath kind of wonders, you know, what was that all about? I heard you say it to each other in the beginning, although it didn't sound as nice. What is it? Is it some sort of greeting or a way to wish someone well? Zira laughed. It's a type of Ukrainian peasant bread. We make it in our fireplaces. I don't get it. The only people who can't pronounce it correctly are the Russians. So when we meet someone we don't know, we challenge them to say Palianitsia. If they can pronounce it, we know they're okay. And if they aren't, they're Russian. And this takes me all the way back, and I never did learn to pronounce it, but I've been there, to Scheveningen, or however it was, a Dutch seaside town in the north of Holland, and only somebody native Dutch, only native Dutch speakers could pronounce it properly. So they would get people they suspected might be Germans or other things to have to say that word. And if they couldn't, it, you know, it outed them. And I thought, wow, you've taken this Russian, I mean, this peasant bread, and you've done the same thing.
And that's real. They are actually doing this in Ukraine. It is a challenge and response. And if you saw the movie Saving Private Ryan, you would see as soldiers were running up on other soldiers, there was a challenge and response. They would yell flash, and then the response would be thunder, because the Germans, the Nazis, could not fully pronounced flash or thunder. They didn't have the TH. So the fact that the Ukrainians are doing this, I just said, I got to put this in the book. It's so cool.
It really is cool. I mean, you know, it's depressing as well as fascinating to recognize so many echoes of World War II.
Yes, a lot of echoes.
Now, I realize that that was part of your design here, trying to write an Alistair MacLean book. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you know, it's fascinating. What we're missing now are code talkers. I mean, you and maybe there is a group out there that, you know, can...
I wouldn't be surprised. The Ukrainians in particular, their intelligence service has been very, very clever with what they've done. So there may be a version of that.
There might, although I'm not sure that digital communications, because, you know, when the code talkers were at work, it was radio.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, it was actual language, and I'm not sure that digital...
The Nazis had the Enigma machine, so that was the real
which turned
tough
out to be their Achilles heel in lots of respects, because they thought it was invulnerable.
Alan Turing was the one who broke it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bletchley Park was where they had the operations, yeah.
At Bletchley, right. Absolutely. But it was indeed Turing, and it was, you know, basically early computers, computational stuff. Mm-hmm. Fascinating story, fascinating man, in the same way that Oppenheimer is a fascinating man. And I don't know if any of you went to see Barbieheimer this weekend, but I thought, you know, that is possibly the most unusual pairing of movies that I can ever remember.
Programming and counter-programming.
That's
which
right.
Which is fantastic. And the box office has been great. The theaters are very happy. The cash registers are ringing. It's wonderful. It's good for the industry.
So we mentioned that this is the 22nd Scott Harbath book. And there are hints in this book that maybe Scott is finding as he's aging that field work is tougher to bounce back from. He hasn't wanted, so let's go back, and for those who don't know it, tell us about the Carlton Group and how that got set up, and then we'll talk about Scott.
Right. So Scott works for a private intelligence organization called the Carlton Group. The Carlton Group is actually based on a real-life CIA person who helped stand up the counterterrorism center at the CIA. He was a brilliant, brilliant strategist, brilliant CIA officer, very active during the Cold War, and got fed up with all the red tape at the CIA. Real-life guy. And left and started his own thing. And as I was watching groups like Blackwater and DynCorp and Triple Canopy, as I was watching kind of the privatization of military operations, I thought it was only a matter of time before you would see intelligence operations privatized, that you could get out from underneath kind of the red tape and all of that sort of stuff. And so I created that in my fictional world for Harvath, where Harvath was always at the mercy of whatever the current administration was. So you'd have a president that liked him and liked using him, thought, I'm going to, you know, let's slip this dog of war. And then you'd have a new president that's like, that, we're not going to do that. Don't like you, you're fired. And so there was a lot of back and forth. Harvath was employed, unemployed, and all that kind of stuff. And so the creating the Carlton Group let me take a fictional organization that was removing some of the weight from the Central Intelligence Agency as its new director was trying to reform it from the inside. But even as he was doing a full top-to-bottom remodel, a rehab, gut renovation of the CIA, there were certain operations that needed to be done. And so those got farmed out to the group that Harvath was with. That's the Carlton Group, and that's where Harvath finds himself.
So Harvath was a Navy SEAL.
He was, and then did ended up preventing an attack on a presidential visit that was by water. And the Secret Service said, you know what, we need more guys like this working for us at the White House to help us stay 3-4 steps ahead of the bad guys. So the White House, they hire him, and the president just says, this guy is too good to keep on defense. We've got to let him loose. We've got to give him every support that he needs. And if the bad guys aren't going to play by the rules. We need at least one guy on the playing field that, you know, has a good moral compass. We're going to say, we're going to kind of look this way, and we're going to let you do what you need to do, but you can't remove the rule book or take away the rule books from somebody who's a sadist, because they'll break rules and they'll be vicious just for the sake, because of the pleasure they get from it. You need somebody with a good core like Harvath, who will only break rules if he has to. And so that's what Harvath was doing for a long time. And then there was a change in the administration, and Harvath had to find something else because the new president did not like the idea of using him that way.
But the guy that starts the Carlton Group eventually, as he's getting older, develops Alzheimer's.
Yes,
and can't lead the Carlton Group. And he had been grooming Harvath basically to take over. But Harvath surprises everybody
and says, no, I won't come out of the field. And this is something interesting about Harvath's personality. Is he's been at this game for a while, and the people back at the Carlton Group think he's too valuable to put in the field, that there's a lot of institutional knowledge, a lot of great experience there, and he should be like a coach recruiting the next generation of players and training them up and teaching them. But he has this thing where he thinks nobody can do this job as well as he can. And he doesn't want to. I think to a certain degree he's afraid what's his life going to look like the day he steps off the field and is no longer kicking indoors and shooting bad guys in the head. I compare him a lot to Tom Brady. You know, Tom Brady's going to retire when Tom Brady wants to retire. And, you know, there's always this risk. Do I stay on the field too long? And in Harvath's circumstances, that could be deadly. That could mark the end of his life if he doesn't time getting out at the right point. If he stays too long, the result is you're dead. So it's very interesting. And he does represent some people I know that are staying in the game. They're taking performance-enhancing drugs because there's no rules against that for special operations guys or guys kind of in the intelligence world or the contract world. So Harvest doing what he can to hang in there. And, you know,
the Norwegian, I love that, Norwegian ninja. I'm addicted to that phrase.
Norwegian spy.
And Harvath did have a wife who was killed.
She was killed the same time his mentor was killed.
He's lived through that, and now he has this new relationship. And so, you know, part of him wonders whether, you know, she has a really, tell us about her job, because she actually has a really big job of her own.
So she's younger than Harvath. She has a very similar background, Solvi Kolstad. And the Norwegians in real life have an all-female Special Forces team. And she worked really hard to make that team and everything, and then was disappointed that she didn't get to do the same operations that the men did, that she could shoot and do all that kind of stuff, but they were using her more to go into villages and speak to the wives and daughters in the village and try to gain intelligence that way. She was not being used to kick indoors and shoot bad guys in the head, which is what she wanted to do, and she eventually quit. And she got recruited by the Norwegian Intelligence Service and did a great job and eventually got moved into like an assistant director position. And now it's taking up all of her time because her main focus is, how do they continue their intel agency if the Russians ever invade Norway? So she's responsible for kind of setting up a shadow group for the Norwegians that on a second's notice, they can go underground and still run all of their spies and all their assets and all that kind of stuff. But she's not as free as she once was to, you know, go off on a vacation with Harvath. And she's not doing operations where they can be in the same city at the same time and share a hotel room for the weekend. So there's a push for her. So it's kind of interesting. She's not sitting around pining for him. She's got her own life and her own career. So it's very interesting to kind of compare and contrast where the two of them are professionally.
Absolutely true. And at some point, he may need to make a choice. Now, that's the only place in this book where events kind of caught up with you, because part of the reason that Norway is being so vigilant is it's Norway and Finland, because Sweden is not in NATO.
They're on their way in.
Yeah,
they're on their way in.
Right.
They weren't at the time when I was writing it.
Officially in. And so if, in fact, then there would be a consolidated all three countries.
Right.
Finland, Sweden in the middle, and then Norway. You wouldn't have to, like, hopscotch.
Right. They're going to combine their air forces together for under one central command for
but
air force.
When you wrote this, you know, Sweden wasn't part of NATO, and so Norway and Finland, it was more, you know, more a question of whether Finland was invaded if Norway would have to. Now it's a more consolidated approach. Again, I find it so interesting that by invading Ukraine, Putin actually
increased the size of NATO. Yeah.
And not only that, as I understand it, the Finns are building a border wall.
Yes, they're building a long border wall.
It's not very far because I've been in Helsinki and St. Petersburg, and also there was a really kick-ass international crime drama, the name of which I, once again, can't remember, that took place in Finland, and they were constantly going back and forth to St. Petersburg. So, I mean, it's not far. And that was a concern with the EU. It was because that border is so porous. How many people, you know, could get to the EU by crossing over into Finland?
Right.
And coming. Anyway, so now they're putting up a wall.
Yeah.
And
it's all,
you know,
backfired on Putin.
Yeah. Creating. So, you know, the whole thing is, I wish there were going to be an end to it soon.
Well, we can hope. I'm hopeful.
I know. I'm hopeful too.
We'll see. But it was so fascinating to write this and write it. You know, I try to beat the headlines. And
right.
My buddy Dan Brown, I believe it was Dan, has said a thriller writer's job is to beat the headlines. And this is the first book that I ever wrote kind of in real time as stuff was happening. And I didn't know, you know, how does it impact the book if maybe one of the nuclear plants melts down and now there's fallout and things like that.
Right.
But again, I wanted to create something that you could pick up this book 10 years from now and have a really great adventure. That just like I could pick up a book tomorrow about World War II that's fiction and still have a really great adventure, even though I know how it ends. But this, I'm really pleased the way that this turned out and that I was able to, you know, time this out to get it into the marketplace. Nothing would have made me happier than for the war to be over by today when the book comes out. But I'm really proud of it. I really think it is definitely the most intense book I've ever written. And
well, there's some fabulous action scenes, and there's some really kick-ass women in this book. I would just like to say it isn't just her, and not Solveig, because she is off stage during this book. So it's other women like Zita that I mentioned that I think. And then I really, you know, like the group in Washington. I like the FBI guy and the people working on all of that. There are a few, you know, I don't know if you watched The Last Jack Ryan, but
I'm watching it now, actually.
Okay, but there's, you know, they touch us on some, and of course Tom Clancy created another off-books operation called The Campus.
Campus, yep.
And also, you know, I think thriller writers and, you know, real people, I mean, real actors, rather, politicians, have perceived the need for a kind of off-the-books, you know.
It's fun. It's the thing we hope is happening out there. That
well,
as bogged
down
as government can get with itself, we hope that there's somebody that can expedite things, right? That can go out when we need them to go do the things that we need done. I think that's a kind of a secret hope that we all harbor.
Well, it really is. And the other thing I think should be clear from this conversation is that it's really hard to live through an unresolved era like this. And I point this out in terms of Jane Austen and Regency novels, because, you know, they go on, and you know, life is wonderful and full of manners and all the rest of it. Meantime, over on the other, until Waterloo, 20 years they lived through that, and it was in June of 1815 that conflict was resolved. Well, right now we go back and we look at the Regency and it makes us feel good and it's safe and it's romance, you know, and it's cozy crime and it's all this wonderful stuff because we know who won.
Right.
We knew how it worked, but we don't have that luxury right at the moment because we don't know how all this is going to play out. So writing a book in this unresolved climate is really, I think, a big challenge. And, you know, I will say truthfully, I didn't think any of the descriptions of this book really told me what this book was about. I had to read it.
Interesting.
I probably would have rewritten, to be honest, I would have rewritten the copy. Yeah, because it sounds much more like it's, you know, just violence and action and all the rest of it. But a lot of the other things that make this book so good don't show up there.
You'll have to go to the Poison Pens website and read the
soft
copy of the book and see if you agree with Barbara.
Well, I found that the book was, when I opened it, quite different as I read through it than I had expected.
Okay. Well, that's great feedback.
Which is fine, you know, which I really like. But I'm just mentioning that in case there are people who think, no, I just don't want to read, you know, violent mercenaries.
Right, because
and lots
it's a lot more than that.
It's way more
than
that.
You know, they used to have copywriters, at the publishing houses who would do that. You know, somebody would read the book and actually try to distill the essence of mm-hmm. the book. And I miss that because I used to enjoy, you know, having those meetings where it's like, wow, okay, wow, oh, you really did notice that theme. Do you think that's important to draw forward and put in the copy?
This is a really big book, and if all you can do is put, you know, a few words on the flap of the jacket, you can't really convey the whole thing.
It is tough, and they always sell, what's the old advertising term? Sell the sizzle, not the steak, right? So you have to find that right Don Draper, Mad Men way of selling it so your audience wants to read it, but you also want to constantly be attracting new readers, too. So how do you appeal to them? So it's point well taken.
Well, I think it's fascinating, and, you know, since this is my bookstore and I can sell it any way I want, that's what I think. Sarah Patrick, do we have any questions from the audience?
We do indeed. Lynn would like to know, will the ladies from the Athena Project return in another novel?
Yes. So, Lynn, you're asking about this one, the Athena Project. Yes, I have a total story all mapped out for the Ladies of the Athena Project. So it's just, it's a matter of, can I do a Harvath book and also do an Athena book and keep the quality up for both? Because I don't want to turn in two books at 80%. I'd rather do just one book at 100%. So that's always my thing, is the quality. So, yes, I would love to, and I just have to figure out how to get an extra hour. I need 24 hours just to get done what I do now, so I'm going to need a 25th hour. I'm going to have to look under the couch cushions and see if I can find it. I don't know where it is. But yeah, I would love to, because I get asked that question a lot, and I know the readers loved that book and would love to see those characters again, and I'd love to bring them back.
Maybe you can create a 16-month publishing cycle.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible too. Anything's possible, yeah.
So that might work out for you. You know, you don't always have to come out in July.
Right.
So maybe that would work.
But what would I do? I wouldn't be able to visit you in 118-degree weather if I didn't come out in July.
Which would be a bonus, all things considered. Brad and I are going out for dinner at the conclusion of this. I suspect that there's going to be iced beverages.
Nice ice-cold martini. Right. I can't wait.
All right, Patrick.
Okay, Tim asks, Brad, 2 years ago you mentioned you wanted to do a book set in Greece. Is that still on your radar?
It still is, and I had actually fully outlined a book in Greece when my agent had encouraged me, because I'm a pantser. I'm very organic. I don't want to limit the story to an outline. I want the story to tell me what it wants to be, and so it's stressful. You come into the office sometimes, and you don't know where you're going, and you just have to sit in front of the computer and will it into existence. But when my agent, who also represents Dan Brown, had suggested I think about outlining, she had me ask Dan if I could see the outline for Da Vinci Code. And I think that's probably what I talked about a couple years ago, that Dan shared with me. He's very generous, shared with me the Da Vinci outline, which was very cool to see. And then I went off and outlined a book, and it was all set in Greece. And as soon as the book was outlined, it took all the excitement out of it for me, because I knew what was going to happen. I like to have the experience that the reader does, where as I'm writing it, I don't know what's going to happen next. My heart's pounding, my palms are sweating. So I love Greece. I did one short story for the Thriller Writers Anthology called The Athens Solution. I set it in Greece, and I've lived in Greece a couple of different times. I'm a big Phil Helene. I love Greece, and so, yes, I would love to eventually set a story there. I have to figure out what it would be, but that would be terrific. I would love it, because the research would be just so much fun.
Great, and tragically, much of Greece is currently on fire.
Rhodes,
the island of Rhodes, where I've been several times, and
airplane went down.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, the climate change is going to make some geopolitical differences as well.
It's already doing that in the Arctic. That's why we were talking about the Chinese coming up over Russia, because the sea ice, the summer is getting longer, so that's navigable much longer than it used to be. So.
Let's see. Ron says, thanks so much for mentioning my favorite war movie, Where Eagles Dare.
So good taste, Ron.
You too like Alistair MacLean.
I do. Just such a great author.
I've read them all, and actually we've only touched, I think, on three. Yeah, but he wrote quite a number.
Yeah, no, amazing, amazing author. And got a lot of movies made. I mean, really
he
successful
did.
Guy.
See the Guns of Navarone?
Yes.
And Ice Station Zebra.
Force 10.
Force 10 from Navarone. And then I think there was one set in the Yucatan or somewhere that was really... I might be confusing him with a different writer, because there was a guy whose name... Well, sorry, Once Again Come to Me, who for a long time, the only thriller set in Iceland was by this guy. And he had written some other interesting locations. And so we used to do book ticks where people would write in and tell us where they were going to go on their, you know, travels or whatever. And we would recommend books in different locations as a way to kind of familiarize yourself. So, it's Desmond Bagley. That's who he is. And have you ever read Desmond Bagley?
I have not.
Oh, if you like Alistair MacLean, you will love Desmond Bagley. But anyway, and it was called Reykjavik something, I can't remember, but we sold tons of copies because people wanted to go to Iceland.
Well, if you are interested in Iceland, I can recommend a great thriller written by Brandon Webb and John Mann that's called Cold Fear. It's the sequel to Steel Fear, and which I blurbed both books, and so Cold Fear is set in Iceland, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, wonderful that you mentioned it, because tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m.
What?
We will be talking to Brandon and David, and also Brian Freeman.
Wow, and what a small world.
I know.
This was not a setup.
No.
I'm a Chicago guy, and normally we work this stuff out in the background and kind of like slide it in. This was not a setup.
No.
Really? Well, you have to tell Brandon I said hello, and
I
then let him know I was pushing his book, because he's a great author.
That. Yeah, no, I'm looking for. We have not previously conversed with them, so I'm
really smart guy.
To it.
And a former Navy SEAL.
Yeah. There's several. Well, there's at least three pairs of writers now writing thrillers.
Okay.
You know, these two guys, and then I can't remember the name of the... I see that all the time. There are two guys that are taking over the Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan Sr. Mark Cameron, and they, too, are writing as a pair and have a military background.
Nice.
So, you know, maybe some of the heavy lifting in writing these big thrillers and all is done more easily with two people.
It may be. It certainly is a trend in the marketplace. Maybe that's how I am able to do another Athena project and a Harvath in the same year. So we'll see what
There are quite a few pairings, you know, coming up. And I think as long as the original voice isn't lost and so
that's
forth,
important.
That it can be. Yeah, it can be. You know, Clive Cussler, our author for forever here, really kind of pioneered that, you know, by... bringing in an author to do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the research and everything as he got older, and it was just got to be too much for him. But he kept...
A lot of time to drive those beautiful, expensive cars around. Hard to get the research done when you're you're as successful as Clive was.
I still look out in the parking lot, don't you, Patrick, and think about Clive. You know, he would drive in and park his wonderful car right there and come in. We kept a bottle of tequila here for him in the back room, and... I really miss Clive. He was part of our life for
Super nice guy. I got to meet him at Thriller Fest. It's just so gracious. Such a lovely man.
But, again, pioneered the idea of taking in a writing partner in order to keep up the level of the books.
Worked with his son a little bit, too, didn't he?
Dirk is actually, Dirk is writing...
Some of the Numa files and stuff. And
he's writing Dirk Pitt.
There are other writers
that worked with Clive who are continuing to write some of the others on their own now. Well-trained. By Clive. Right.
No doubt.
Yep.
Let's see. Carolyn asks, Brad, you're always so up to date on world events. How do you get your information without the media bias?
You got to go to lots of different sources. So I spread it around. I mean, I will read Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy. I'm at Fox. I'm at CNN. I am everywhere because I think the more streams of information you can get, the better informed you'll be and the more capable you'll be of forming an opinion as to, okay, where's really the true story here. So I try to gather it from all over. It's a great question. Consume a lot of news.
Do you read foreign news sources as well?
So there's there's even more stuff here. So Reuters, and then there's Agence Presse, the French. So not as much. I do read some of the British stuff, And that's all across the board. You've got, you know, from the Telegraph and the Guardian to the Daily Mail. So there's a lot. You can drive yourself crazy, actually. You've got to limit it because it's like drinking from a fire hose. At some point, I got to get my writing done, you know.
Actually, the Guardian sometimes is more up to date on what's going on in America.
It is stunning. Yeah. The Guardian does get a lot of scoops.
I subscribe to it, and I'm often amazed at how it's up to date.
Yeah, they're reporting on our weather here in Phoenix, for instance. let's see. Tell us about Sister Dimes. What was the lady with the dimes?
Sister Mary Dimes? Oh, Patrick was asked. So I had told Patrick this story off camera when I was signing books. By the way, to all of you who pre-ordered, thank you, thank you, thank you. That is so helpful to an author. I spent a long time before we came on camera signing books, so thank you. If you want a signed book and you haven't gotten one, signed a bunch of extras, and Poison Pen has them. They ship around the world, so no matter where you're watching this from, they can get the book to you. So Sister Mary Dimes, I went to Catholic school in Chicago, and I was chatting with Patrick, who you can't see, who's off camera, and I told him about an experience. We had a nun at our school, and she'd sub for other teachers, and her name was Sister Donata, and we called her Sister Mary Dimes because for every syllable you spoke out of turn without being recognized by Sister Donata, it was a dime for the Catholic missions in Africa. And she had this little milk, like the kind of school milk carton that you would get with your school lunch, and had a slit in the top. And you'd have to come up and put your money in at the end of class. She kept track on the blackboard. And so we called her Sister Dimes, Sister Mary Dimes. Lovingly so. She was a wonderful woman. She took no guff from us boys.
Sorry, you may not have wanted to reveal that. Fred says, Brad, is there any aspect of writing that you've not mastered yet? And what keeps you going as a writer? What goals do you currently have?
So, Fred, that's a great question. I believe that as an author, you can constantly be getting better. So I spend a lot of my time between books actually reading books on writing. Who's the author? Is it Jerry Jenkins, the Left Behind series? I think it's Jerry Jenkins, but Jerry Jenkins has got a YouTube channel, and he is one of the most giving authors I've ever seen. He has so many episodes about writing, and I actually find myself from time to time clicking on his videos because it's now in my algorithm, so a lot of stuff gets pushed at me. But I always want to, I believe I can get better with my plot twist, with my character development, things like that. And it's funny because I had dinner with Vince Flynn, the creator of the Mitch Rapp series, and we were talking about Kyle Mills, my friend Kyle, who just turned in his last, Code Red is the last Mitch Rapp book that Kyle Mills is writing.
Can I do a commercial here for just one moment? All right, so the handoff between Kyle Mills and Don Bentley will happen here Poison Pen on Monday, September 11th, and your amazing publicist, whom you recognize.
I dedicated Deadfall
book,
to David
Brown, one of the world's most superb publicists, has orchestrated that. So it's going to be a really nifty
Not set up. Not set up. No. I just raised this.
I know you did, but I think it's been that Don Bentley is one of those authors that, as I often say, I've raised from a pup
Nice.
All the way through. And, you know, Kyle is a very dear friend, and I'm very pleased that Don is going to be taking over.
Yeah, the franchise is in great hands.
Yep,
with
and
Don.
Then Don's Clancy books are moving on to, it'll come to me in a minute. And so there's a turnover, and I think that maybe keeping these heroic franchises going, it does need fresh
eyes and a fresh take and a fresh perspective.
That's right. Yep.
So to finish Patrick's, it was Fred's question, right? Patrick, that you asked. So Fred, I had dinner with Vince Flynn, and I talked to Vince about this, about, you know, you can always be getting better as a writer and all this kind of stuff. And Vince looked at me and he said, listen, the way I look at it is if you're batting 300 and you know you're going to make the Hall of Fame, why would you start messing with your swing? And I thought that legit, that's fine. Yeah. Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. As the director of the OMB back in the Carter administration, Bert Lance, said, I actually had that in Lions of Lucerne. I wrote that. I had a character say that. And I heard from Bert Lance. One of the first pieces of fan mail I ever got was from Bert Lance, a former OMB director under Jimmy Carter. The second piece of fan mail I got was from the other side of the aisle, was from Newt Gingrich, who was a huge reader And he raved about how Lions of Lucerne had captured America's enemies better than any Washington, D.C. think tank. And I was very proud of the fact that my two first big pieces of fan mail came from left and from right. And I said, okay, that's a pretty neat thing if you can have people enjoy the book like that. So anyway, but Vince's thing, don't mess with your swing. Okay, that's fine. My dad, no longer active Marine, said, if you're going to be a broom pusher, you'd be the best damn broom pusher in the world, and you keep working on your broom pushing. So don't peek is what my dad says. So I'm constantly trying to get better. So I read in between books on writing and like Jerry Jenkins stuff on YouTube. If you're a writer, I can't recommend his videos enough. He's fabulous, very generous guy and very honest with what he reveals about his process. It's impressive.
Maybe to kind of wrap it up, there are a couple of questions about Lions of Lucerne, and yeah. You know, you've been talking about it for several years as far as a possible movie or TV project.
Yeah,
is that going to happen?
So we are at a studio. They asked me who I wanted to have direct our series, to do it as a TV series, and I said anybody in Hollywood. They said yeah, anybody in Hollywood. You pick this person, and I got the guy I wanted. He's not done television. He is the biggest action guy out there. He's absolutely incredible. We have great producers. And the big thing was finding the right writer who could bring Harvath to the screen, who wasn't just a writer, but who understood Harvath, who had read the books. And we had a great writer. His name was Manny Cotto. And Manny had written a lot of the 24 episodes with Kiefer Sutherland. Great writer. He did the 2021 series of American Horror Story, which if you love writers, it is all about writers and artists that disappear into Provincetown off-season and end up getting tricked into taking this pill that makes them extra creative but turns them into vampires. So they write like 5 bestsellers in the winter, like they write Da Vinci Code 5 times in 5 different ways, but then they end up having a thirst for blood. It's fabulous. That was Manny's stuff. And Manny is, it was fantastic. We had to put a pause. We were about to go out to Netflix and Amazon Prime and all of it. So the cablers and all this kind of stuff. And the writer strike happened and we had to push pause. And 2 weeks ago, unfortunately, Manny passed away from pancreatic cancer. Yeah. Just such a, his family had left Cuba. I mean, this guy was Mr. Red, White, and Blue, and it was devastating to lose, not only professionally, but personally, just a super, super guy. And so, you know, our hearts and our condolences still go out to Manny's family and his friends. He was just a lovely, lovely guy and a legend in Hollywood. So we're not going to be able to replace him. It's just impossible. Those shoes are not going to get filled. So we have to wait until the strike is over because we're not allowed to talk to any writers.
Right.
Producers can't talk to writers until the strike is over. So once the strike is over, then we're going to go out and start talking to writers again. And hopefully we'll find somebody like Manny, who is a fan of the Brad Thor books, and gets the universe and gets Harvath. We'll find it.
I certainly hope so. And I hope that the strike, you know, doesn't go on forever. I hope that everybody gets to win.
Yeah.
You know, writers and actors and,
yeah.
You know, and you don't want the studios to be totally devastated either.
Mm-mm.
So, I hope there will be some compromise that will be achieved. I'm really cheered that the UPS strike settled today.
Yeah.
So, you know, hope that maybe, you know, something good will happen.
Back to Neville Chamberlain, peace in our time.
Yep.
Let's see what happens, Hollywood.
Right. Anything else, Patrick? That was it. Well, thank you all very much for joining us. Love your questions, and I'm grateful for your participation. Brad is correct that we still have autographed copies of Deadfall. We ship anywhere in the world, and you can order them through our website, poisonedpen.com, or you can call 888-560-9919 and probably leave a message, and somebody will call you back and take your order. But it's easier to order through the web store because then all your information will be captured. So don't miss out. It's a really superb book, and it'll be very interesting to read it over the next few weeks and wait and see what real events transpire. And, you know, sometimes I find that thriller writers are better at depicting reality or real things than you ever expect. And so it may be that what you have said here may actually be the way it goes.
As Mark Twain said, the difference between fiction and reality is people expect fiction to make sense. So that's our job. We make it make sense.
Oh, my God. He keeps quoting. It's wonderful.
It's martini time.
I know. Now we're going. Is. So thank you all very much. Good night.
Thank you, everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.